And turn things over to your official session moderator, Andrew Seth from Sustainable Strategies. Andrew, I'll go ahead and pull up that content and let you kick things off for today.
Perfect. Thank you, Jean, and thanks everyone for joining us today. This is Andy Seth at Sustainable Strategies DC, and welcome to the Meet the Funders webinar focused on parks, community health, and the arts. And this is the fourth in this series of webinars that we're doing with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And the purpose of these, so many of the folks on the phone today are EPA brownfield grantees, and they're getting assessment dollars, cleanup dollars, or other help to think about community revitalization and turning those sites around. Those brownfield dollars don't need to be the last dollars that get invested in your community priorities. There are a number of opportunities across the federal landscape to support those goals. And again, this is the fourth in this series. We've featured webinars on infrastructure and economic development and sustainability. And we're highlighting in each of these webinars three or so federal agencies that have a wealth of programs that can be used to invest in your communities. Today, again, we're talking about parks, community health, and the arts. So we're going to have on, and I'll advance to this next slide, and I'll introduce these folks later in the webinar, but we're going to have folks on from the National Park Service talking about a few programs that you can access there. There is a forthcoming opportunity from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It's a big dollar and can really support economic development and community health in your locales. And finally, the National Endowment for the Arts has a number of recurring programs. There'll be a cycle coming up pretty soon that you can take advantage of to do creative placemaking and to really showcase the unique sense of place of your particular cities. So I'll introduce all of these folks later. We're also going to be joined by the City of Omaha, who has tapped into some of these resources. Omaha is doing amazing community revitalization work, and we're going to hear about how they're using some of the funds that we'll talk about today to support that. So just a real quick recap of the agenda. What we're going to focus on first is the funders themselves. So each of the funders is going to have 15 minutes to present some of the background and basics of their particular programs. And the order we'll go in is National Park Service, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the National Endowment for the Arts. And if you've participated on these webinars before, we do this in a format that I'll ask some questions, and they'll provide some of the answers that give you the lay of the land of these particular funding opportunities. There'll be time at the end for Q&A, so if you've got particular questions, if you want to go a little bit deeper into any of these programs, throughout the webinar there's a feature that you can type your questions in, and we'll get to those questions at the end. Once we have heard from the federal agencies, again, we'll have James Thiel on from the City of Omaha. James is the planning director there, and he'll talk about how to apply these resources with your own community revitalization priorities. We're going to start today with a few introductory remarks from the host of the webinar, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and I've got Amy Storm here to welcome everyone and to get us started.
Thanks, Andy. Hi, everyone. I did want to just take a minute or two to set some context for why we are doing this series, and it's been so beneficial, I think, over the last few months as we've met with other federal agencies and shared what it is that the different opportunities that they have and how they can support community development, and in particular brownfields revitalization. We've been spending time here in our program really trying to encourage folks to think about how to identify, plan, and align their resources so that they can actually implement the brownfield reuse plans that they've set in place for themselves. And so just thinking about what that looks like, you know, we've spent time, and we encourage you to be working with your community to think about, you know, how you want to clean up and reuse your brownfield sites, and in particular for the purpose of this webinar, you know, where do public parks and community health and the arts, how do they fit into those reuse visions? How can those projects serve as real catalysts for, you know, making other economic development happen in your community? And how can this just support better rounded overall public health and social outcomes for what you're trying to accomplish? So really thinking about how these types of reuses can be done on brownfield sites and how they fit into your community's vision for a healthy community. But it takes a lot to make that happen, and you really need to be thinking about how you're going to plan and implement. And so we think about it in terms of, you know, not only knowing what you need on property specifically, assessing and cleaning up your site, but what other type of site improvements do you need, really taking a close look at the funding and investment that you already have and making some decisions around how to target those resources to make these types of catalyst projects happen, and then considering all the different sources of other funding that you might not have now but could access. And so part of today's webinar we'll be talking about that, whether it's grants, technical assistance, financing, and what your partners can bring to the table. And then just to recap with some of the things that we've been working on here to promote leveraging, as Andy mentioned, this is our fourth in this series of leveraging webinars, and so the other ones are archived on CLUIN, as Jean mentioned earlier. So the link is here, and you can just go back and search for the three webinars that we did last year, and then we have one more coming up on April 25th when we'll talk about financing, and so we hope that you mark your calendars, join us for that. Last year we set out a guidebook that really set the stage for all of this, which we called Setting the Stage for Leveraging Resources for Brownfields Revitalization. Again, an opportunity for you to take a look at that and think about how you can be working within your own community to get ready to leverage resources and what does it take. I always want to make sure that folks on this phone know that we have an ongoing technical assistance opportunity available through the Council of Development Finance Agencies. This is an organization that EPA has given a grant to, and any brownfields community can reach out to them for funding and financing advice on how to, you know, move forward with brownfield sites in their community. So I encourage you to please look at the technical assistance that they offer and reach out to them. Then just really quickly, we do put together a brownfields funding guide, federal program guide, most recently updated 2 years ago. We're working on an updated one for our upcoming Brownfields Conference, which will be in Pittsburgh in December this year. And we do also have online a matrix of federal resources that we've shared for area-wide planning grantees. So various things that we've been doing to try to help get the word out about different funding opportunities. And so please take a look. And thank you all for joining us today. I'll turn it back over to Andy.
Thanks, Amy. So we're going to jump right into it now with the federal agencies. And just before I get started with the National Park Service, just so many communities out there have interesting projects and they are looking to get them off the ground. Funding is a key driver in you know, what happens next. And if you don't have the dollars, you don't have the projects happening in communities. These are three agencies that have resources that can support your livability projects. And as we're working with communities across the country, we urge them to put together a resource roadmap and to list and identify what those programs are that can support those projects, to find out when the time frames are when those dollars are going to be available, to identify who at these agencies can talk to them about these programs, and to figure out matches and all the requirements. This conversation today is helping you jumpstart that. And you're going to hear some information that if you've got these projects coming down the pike, these kind of resources, plug these into your strategies and begin to put together, you know, the applications, the background materials, the partnerships, whatever you need to be competitive for these funds. And these funds are competitive. There are a number of communities that chase these every year, so you need to be at the top of your game. So let's start with the National Park Service, and we'll have the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the NEA on next. But let me introduce Joel Lynch. Joel has served as Chief of State and Local Assistance Programs Division of the National Park Service for 5 years. And in this role, he administers the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is a program that flows from the National Park Service to your states. And he also helps run the Local Assistance Program, the Federal Lands to Parks Program, and the Urban Park and Recovery Program. So the National Park Service, if you've got green space, if you want to do parks, if you want to encourage recreation in your community, this is the agency at the federal level that you need to be paying attention to. And with that, Joel, I'm going to ask my first question of you. And as communities are thinking about their community revitalization, what role do parks and open space play in that? Joel, take it away.
Thanks, Andy, and I'm happy to be here to talk about some of the programs I oversee and some of the other programs my colleagues oversee. So the first question that Andy's asking is lends itself to a lot of the work that's associated and connected to brownfields. We've seen lots of examples, and I'm sure in many communities that in your own communities you can find examples of how this is connected to. But what we do is promote the notion of parks and open space and how they're connected within our communities. And you don't have to think very far, but to your own experiences in your own community to kind of really understand what parks can really mean too. And we often say there's lots of benefits, but I've just listed some of them here. The parks are places to bring folks together, whether it be family or friends or whole communities for various causes in one way or another. Parks can also be places to inspire. Think of the youth soccer leagues and kids dreaming of success down the road in terms of youth sports or just even an opportunity to be wowed by the nature and aspects around them. Places to reduce stress obviously are good places like parks. Certain parks, certainly bigger parks, can be economic drivers, and lots of research is out there that shows examples of how parks and the adjacent communities go hand in hand in terms of economic development and the desirability of living near those parks. Promoting culture and arts through various programs embedded within parks, and then a little bit less known are, you know, how parks can remain beneficial in terms of the ecological functions within those communities, within neighborhoods, and within cities themselves. And of course, if you've spent any time in the park, especially recently, just around a playground watching the kids run around, have fun, and grow, you know, can be an important aspect of what we do. And so those are the kind of things that we in the National Park Service, through some of the programs I oversee and my colleagues, do to promote how the connecting brownfields to parks.
Thanks, Joel. And parks need to be a part of every successful community's strategy. As it relates to the National Park Service, can you begin to describe some of the programs that can help communities create those recreational opportunities?
Absolutely. So the National Parks, everybody thinks of the National Parks Service as the park units that are either out west or the cultural parks that are typically on the East Coast. But part of our mission, a good chunk of our mission, relates to how the Park Service provides assistance to communities nationwide in every corner from every state to every territory and to the District of Columbia as well. And the Park Service, there's a number of programs. On our cultural side has a number of programs that can in many ways relate to some of the activities in brownfields. But today I'm going to just talk about two particular programs as it relates to the parks aspect of what the National Park Service mission is trying to bring. And those two are through technical assistance, and that's through the Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program. And then on the other side, that's a technical assistance, and the other side where the money is the Land and Water Conservation Fund and the state local assistance programs.
Excellent, Joel. And I know you're going to dive deeper now, so start to talk to the communities out there. And we've got lots of cities across the country who may be a little familiar with these programs, but what do they need to really think about as they're beginning to compete for this? What makes a winning application?
Yep. So I'll first talk about, and I've segmented these two by those two programs I just mentioned, and do a little deeper dive, as Andy had mentioned. So River Trails and Conservation, now referred to as the RTCA program, and I'm sure many of folks out there have probably heard of it. So this is a national network. There's around 85 Park Service individuals that have expertise in conservation, recreation, or a combination of the two as it relates to planning. And their goals are to work with communities, and we'll talk a little bit about sort of some of the types of projects they work with, but really to help lead and guide those communities and other areas in really the development of recreation projects. And these aren't just parks themselves. It could also be open space, it could be conservation-oriented kind of things, access. I mean, there's a whole litany of programs, big and small, associated with the RTCA program that are examples out there for folks to consider. So in terms of who is typically involved, and really the RTCA program provides assistance pretty much to anybody that's working in those communities. So that could be a state, it could be a local unit of government or department, a recreation department, or even Native American tribes or other nonprofits that are supporting some sort of recreation or conservation project within that community. And the RTCA program is fairly popular, and, you know, 85, there's always any number of projects. These are sometimes multiple years, sometimes simple projects. But there's always an application period that begins or actually is submitted at the June timeframe, at the end of June. And we always encourage folks to reach out to their contacts. And you'll see a link to the RTCA page with those contacts at the regional levels, really to begin that discussion as it relates to some of the ideas they have, because that's where it starts. Because of all those networks that are out there, there might be tapping into networks and expertise that are scattered throughout the country. And so that's really the beginning part of all this. In terms of the project selection, this is just some points to think of and consider. Obviously, every project, the more well thought out a project is, the better off it's going to be, especially when it comes to the assistance that can be provided through the RTCA program. And clearly understanding who are the players is an important aspect of the project selection itself. Obviously, you want to see that there's widespread support. The more support there is, obviously, the easier it is for projects to get going. And obviously, it's got to have a connection. Whatever the project is, has to have a connection to the National Park Service mission. Many of you know we're about parks. We're also about conservation. We're also about culture. We're also about history as well. So it's pretty easy to fit into the mission of the National Park Service. And then the project has to fit sort of one or more of these key Park Service strategic initiatives. And these initiatives evolve a little bit over time. And so I'm just going to touch upon in the next slide here those strategies that they exist at this point. So those strategic initiatives revolve around health, and obviously recreation lends itself to that. There's a large component associated with youth engagement in terms of projects that are out there encouraging youth not only to be active in the development of conservation areas and the development of parks in their local communities, but the whole assortment of other activities associated with that. Obviously, we're providing some sort of connection to parks through some sort of physical development, be it helping guide a community through the development of access or some sort of trails, which are popular, particularly in urban areas, and particularly in a lot of urban redeveloped areas as well. A lot of the Park Service projects also, and there's a specific emphasis in the National Park Service to work with the adjacent communities to those units of the National Park Service and providing, you know, a whole litany of ways to encourage and develop the connection between the National Park Service itself and those local communities. A whole litany of different types of projects associated with natural and conservation type things. And then we have a number of folks that are experts in really developing access to water areas, which can be a challenge in many urban environments. So that's RTCA, and we'll have a link at the end as I move on through this presentation that will provide some, a little bit more background about some information. So I wanted to move into the program, one of the programs that I oversee, and that's the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And many folks might have heard about this. It's a over 50-year-plus program. And this is a matching program, 50-50, so every dollar invested at the local or state level is matched at the federal level. And it's the program is geared toward, goes towards the states and through the states to local units of government. So long as it's a government entity, it's available for participation in the program. And there's two parts of this program at current iteration. So there's a traditional program, formula program, which is funding that goes to the states. Talk a little bit more detail about that. And then relatively recently, as the last couple years, another national program that has begun through congressional initiative. So the state formula program or the state assistance program, so what happens, Congress appropriates funds. In the case of last fiscal year, it was around about $100 million, so we're talking a substantial amount of money. Those funds are allocated out to all the states, the D.C., and the territories by a formula driven out of the Act. And the funds are available to the states, and it's really this partnership program is between the National Park Service and the states, and it's really the state's responsibility to create that program. And obviously, if it's over 50 years, we've got a long-term relationship with these folks, but it's up to the state's programs. And it's really where it starts in terms of information about the program itself. And I've had the link there. Most of our state partners are designated, or I should say, just back up a little bit. Most of the partners we work with are directly related to the state park systems within a state, but many of the other programs also are related to granting entities within in any given state. The easiest way to usually find is just to type in land and water and the state that you reside in to get more information. Every state has to publish or at least provide information about how the program works within that state, the timing of it, the sort of goals, how it really functions, because there the state is responsible for the project selection aspect of this program. And then the other program I talked about is this national competitive program that began in 2014, and it's termed, and folks might have heard about this, as Outdoor Recreation Legacy Partnership, and it was targeted specifically at urban and city areas and designed to, and many might have heard this in many ways, it's the play gaps or areas of communities that do not have park and recreation. The intent of the program was to sort of fill in those gaps through pretty substantial investment, either through the acquisition or the development of park and recreation. And so those projects were, you know, as I mentioned, they're given to those economically disadvantaged areas that really did lack access to recreational resources. Just a couple other quick things about some considerations. So Land and Water is about outdoor recreation and public outdoor recreation, I might add. So you can see on the left-hand side some of our activities. We've had projects over the years. Everything, every sport imaginable or playfield imaginable is certain eligible funding. Trails, bikeways have become more and more popular. Access to water bodies through hunting and fishing, those kind of things, camping and some of the larger park units themselves, boating, swimming pools, spray parks are very, very popular these days. And things traditionally not associated with active-based recreation, such as community gardens, open spaces within communities, even if there's just a few trees and less grass, and it's more about the community spaces inside of a major urban area. Everything then from some sort of cultural or spectator facilities, and then everything associated with supporting those facilities from a maintenance and operation end of things. So things we don't really do are indoor, as we talked about being outdoor recreation, and certainly commercial enterprises and things of this nature that lend itself more to the private sector. And one last important consideration that's a large part of the vision for the Land and Water Program that started in 1965, and many probably are familiar with this aspect as well. So land and water and any assisted site has to be protected in perpetuity. And the vision from Congress back in 1964 was to create this recreation, this unique legacy of recreation estate that's protected. And the notion is that so long as the Act is still around, that community will always have available open space and community space. Doesn't mean that it can't change, but the provisions associated with the protection of that site make it a little bit more challenging to ensure that it's protected and that the park itself or the open space itself is not converted to some other use, such as private development or other public uses, such as a firehouse or things of that nature.
And Joel, one more question from me. You fund a lot of different park projects, and a lot of these are very interesting and innovative types of projects. Just a few tips on where communities should go and begin to explore the kind of work that you funded and the kind of work that they might be able to replicate back home.
Sure. So for inspiration, I've provided a link there, and the website should be accessible right now. And that map there also is an indication of every RTCA project since the beginning. When I talked about sort of the litany of different types of assistance provided, and I'll just use an example, one small example, which is huge in our area here in the D.C. metro area. Through an RTCA program, they support in conjunction with both the state of Virginia or the Commonwealth of Virginia, state of Maryland and the district. There was a project or a series of projects where they involved looking at access to the Potomac River, which bisects both or all three jurisdictions. And all was simply just a map with information about access, be it for fishing, be it for hiking, be it for canoeing or whatnot. So that's the type of project, was an example of the type of project that can be, that RTCA has been involved with. And everything from what we've talked about from brownfields on up, small and big, can be tied into that program itself. And for land and water, because we're going on close to over $4.2 billion have been allocated to the LWCF state and local assistance program. So if you match that 50-50, and we know many more projects are matched greater than that, you're talking over $8 billion. So imagine that over the 50 years that there's quite a number of projects that are out there. So to date, roughly about 40 to 45,000 grants have been awarded since then. The vast majority of these grants have gone into local park and recreation projects, so that's not necessarily state projects. And right now, or at least as of about 4 or 5 years ago when we last did this, there's an LWCF project in 98% of the counties nationwide. So this is something, one of the few unique programs in the National Park Service that literally touches every community out there. And the information, that second website that's down below there, is information about the state assistance program. Covers much of many of the points that I had made earlier. And then also there's a link to, for those that you really want inspiration to find what's, because I can almost guarantee most of the people, most of the folks on the phone, probably an LWCF that you're familiar with project in your neighborhood. There's a website that links that just provides a tabular information, and we're working to identify these places on the ground physically.
Excellent, Joel. Thank you so much. We're going to have a Q&A period at the end of the webinar. So if you've got questions about these particular programs, go ahead and type those questions in. We see some coming in already. So Joel, you'll get some follow-up in just a couple of minutes. Let me shift gears, and we're going to move now to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And we're joined by Harold Taylor. Harold is a program specialist with HHS's Office of Community Services. He has more than 7 years of professional experience in the Community Economic Development Program. And it's the CEP program that Harold's going to talk about today, and they've got a funding opportunity that is forthcoming. So, Harold, take it away, and let me ask the first question, which is, from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services perspective, what is the role of healthy food and healthy living in community revitalization?
Absolutely. Andrew, thank you. The healthy food community, healthy food, was called, the acronym is HHFFI, and it says Healthy Food Initiative. And it was an initiative that was started by by Michelle Obama during the Obama administration, and they wanted to address the food deserts across the United States, and particularly rural areas and also urban areas. And essentially, we've allocated at least $8 million a year towards grantees, and at least 10 lucky grantees got funded each year. And so one of the roles that that played that we determined was that that healthy food played a role in closing access to healthy foods in lower income communities across the United States. And again, in particularly urban areas and also rural areas. And we thought that was pretty successful over the last 4 years in meeting that goal. And we also, one of the other roles is bringing healthy food choices to communities and food deserts that through the establishment of new healthy food retail outlets. Now, there were a lot of co-ops and or farmers markets that popped up out of this program that traditionally didn't have the resources to start something like this. So it's been very helpful in creating healthy communities and also to provide income to individuals with low income so that they can become self-sufficient. A lot of projects that we funded had grocery stores, that the grocery stores in urban areas and rural areas, and these grocery stores were either startup or a family-owned grocery store or a franchise, and we would provide up to $800,000 to these stores for operating costs, and so they can actually buy more equipment and upgrade the store and increase their market share. And so this would allow that particular grocery store to hire more people from that community, particularly low-income people, which helped change their lives and help them become self-sufficient in many cases in our project. So those are some of the roles that the healthy food play in creating a healthy community.
Excellent, Harold. And I know this is where I wanted you to do a deeper dive, and particularly on the two programs that you've funded over the years, and these are big dollar amounts that you pump into communities. It's the Community Economic Development Program and a subset of that, the Healthy Food Financing Initiative. Can you talk about those programs and how you're helping communities grow local food businesses?
Sure. In the Office of the Community Service, the mission is to work in partnership with states, communities, and other agencies to provide a range of human and economic development services and activities which can ameliorate the causes of poverty and also assist people in need. So particularly the aim of these services and activities is to increase the capacity for individuals and families to become self-sufficient. And the goal is also to revitalize that community and to help rebuild and stabilize the capacity of particularly children, youth, and families so that they can become able to create their own opportunities. And so we basically in fiscal year 2016, the Community Economic Development Program provided $17.7 million in grants. The maximum amount that a grantee can receive is $800,000, and for the projects. And the project was designed to address, the needs of that particular community, and create employment and business opportunities for that community. And so we have a lot of, we've been very successful at doing it over the past 10 years. And also, Community Economic Web Program seeks to provide funds that address personal and community barriers that must be overcome to help those individuals and low-income people become self-sufficient. There's individuals who've had individual issues with child care, transportation, and other, you know, personal or community barriers that have to be addressed. So we generally fund grantees who partner with, who show in their application how they're going to address those community barriers and those personal barriers. You have people who have been incarcerated or single moms or single dads, and they need some social services, what we call wraparound services. So, again, in the application, they have to show how they partner with social service agencies and job employment agencies to address these issues. Funds can be used for costs associated with participating in business startup or expansion activities, provided that the expenditures result in the creation of new positions that can be filled by the key is low-income individuals. Now, only 75% of the newly created jobs have to be created by low-income individuals. So out of the 100% of jobs created, 75% are created by low-income individuals, designated for low-income individuals. The objective of the program is to support businesses that develop new products and services and other commercial activities that result in the creation of, again, new jobs and new positions. We don't fund projects that are essentially training projects, or we don't give our money to entities that just simply provide training for individuals, but we give our money to projects that create new jobs and positions. And we understand that some training has to take place specific to that particular job. The objective of the program is to support businesses that develop new products, services, and other commercial activities that result in the creation of new positions and are ready to implement at the time of award. That's really key. Shows that they lead to increased self-sufficiency for individuals and families with low income. And the project has to either create businesses and jobs for low-income people in that community that can improve the livelihood, is not only those obtained through jobs, but the community itself. We also want to attract additional public and private funds to increase investment. We talk about leveraging, that's the key. We want to increase the investment and quality of life in low-income communities. So sometimes you'll have projects that are very extensive where they bring in new market tax credits and tax increment financing, and major construction projects. And we encourage that, no matter how difficult it may be to bring everything together, we encourage that. So, okay, the CED HMI program seeks to fund projects that implement strategies to address the Healthy Food Finance Program in particular seeks to address food deserts, as I talked about earlier. So we can move on to the next question. Okay, we have seeks to address projects that address food deserts, as I talked about earlier, and increase healthy access to low-income communities. So I talked about that earlier, and we focus on funding startup, business startups and expansions, and the key is to create new positions for low-income individuals. And 75% of these positions have to be for low-income individuals.
So, Harold, you've got a particular kind of grantee that you're looking for. Can you talk to folks about the CDCs that you work with and what a community needs to identify to go pursue your dollars?
Okay. Absolutely. Eligibility for the CED and HFI program and that. First of all, an applicant must be a private nonprofit CDC with 501c3 or 501c3 status applicant must have articles of incorporation or bylaws demonstrating that the CDC has as a principal purpose the planning, developing, or managing of long-term housing or CD activities. And the board of directors must have representation from each of the following: community residents, business leaders, and civic leaders.
So there are CDCs across the country in every community. So more likely than not, your community has a CDC working to accomplish these kind of goals. It's that organization that needs to pursue the community economic development dollars. And lastly, Harold, you guys have thrown a lot of money out on the street. These are big grants and can be very transformative. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of projects you fund and some examples of success?
Absolutely. Well, some examples of successful projects that were funded by CED and HHFI include financing major construction of grocery stores, providing direct assistance to farmers, supporting urban farmers markets and urban retail markets, expanding existing food distribution businesses and manufacturing, and supporting food business entrepreneurs. Grantees can also provide a low-interest loan to local businesses in that community and become a equity partner. Or they can, again, they can provide a low-interest loan, which is a key of below market rate. One of the examples of a successful project is project that's the flagship project in all across the United States, and they're based out of Kentucky. And the project is called the Kentucky Highlands Investment Corporation. And this particular project has created over 200 jobs, I would say about 500 jobs since they've been getting funded, along with people throughout that Kentucky area, the mid-Kentucky area. And one of the projects they're doing is they're making a low-interest loan to Phillips Diversified Manufacturing in Clay County, Kentucky. And the loan itself will be used for working capital necessary to support a contract expansion of a global technology company and leading manufacturing supplier in printing imaging solutions. This project has already created over 40 new jobs for low-income individuals. And they leveraged over $1 million for this project as well. So this is one of the examples, and I also provided a link with their website for the actual grantee. And so if you guys want to come click on that link later and take a look at it, see what they're doing, that'd be awesome. We have plenty more to share, but this is, to me, one of the most successful organizations that we funded over the past 10 years.
Excellent, Harold. And again, these dollars can support just regular economic development and healthy foods as well. So this is an example of one of the economic development projects that this funding has supported. The EPA Brownfields Program has done a number of revitalization projects that have resulted in grocery stores and farmers markets and healthy food. So this is a good connection between what a lot of folks are doing with their EPA dollars and what another agency can help support. So we're going to round third now with the National Endowment for the Arts, and this is talking about creative placemaking and bringing arts and culture to your communities. We're joined today by Jennifer Hughes. She's a community solutions specialist for NEA, and in this position, she manages federal, philanthropic, and local relationships to strategically integrate arts and culture into community revitalization. She has managed the Our Town program. This is a program that local governments can tap into, and a number of you might be familiar with this. And she currently oversees the Citizens Institute on Rural Design. So, Jen, just as I asked the previous speakers, what is the role of arts and culture in community revitalization? How does NEA look at this?
Great. Thanks, Andy. So excited to be here today. And so just as a bit of background to that question, I thought I would start with a study that came out over a three-year period that was conducted by the Knight Foundation. And this is really intended to dig deeper into understanding what makes people attached to the places where they live. What was really surprising was that the three elements that rose to the top were social offerings, openness, and aesthetics, all elements that can be enhanced via arts, culture, and design activities. So this was really interesting to see that basic services, leadership, the local economy, safety, all of these items ranked lower in terms of how residents felt about where they live. So this really forms the basis of the Creative Placemaking Program here at the NEA. And so I just wanted to start by both defining creative placemaking, but also helping to expand your imagination in terms of what this work looks like and how it plays out in local communities. So really, the idea that arts and culture has been having a profound impact on the places where we live is not a new idea, but the terminology is relatively new. And the NEA defines creative placemaking as when artists, arts organizations, and community development practitioners deliberately integrate arts and culture into community revitalization work, placing arts at the table with land use, transportation, economic development, education, housing, infrastructure, and public safety strategies. So we at the NEA really see creative placemaking as part of a comprehensive place-based strategy to impact the quality of life and economic development in communities. So at the NEA, we are asking the question, what role can arts and culture play in improving economic opportunity, in creating jobs, and improving things like public safety? So I'm just going to dive very quickly into five projects that I wanted to introduce you to as snippets of inspiration. Each are using arts and culture to address community challenges in really creative ways. So the first project is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The mayor there has been really focused on stewarding his Welcoming Pittsburgh initiative to guide the immigrant integration effort there. Our town is supporting artists to work directly with social service organizations that are serving the new immigrant communities from Bhutan, Burma, Iraq, Somalia, Mexico, and other countries by instigating civic engagement through public art, performance, and cultural exchange. And this is an example of a project intended to really bridge divides that exist in the community and facilitate relationships between existing residents and new immigrants. And it really becomes the baseline for helping to shape the future inclusive community planning efforts in the city. So now moving on to Chattanooga, Tennessee, we had a project where we funded the design fees for their main terrain park that serves as an anchor, addresses stormwater issues in the area, and becomes a new amenity in downtown. And it even has a really cool feature of interactive sculptures that are both movable to encourage physical activity and address public health issues with obesity. And what was interesting about this project is previously it was a vacant and abandoned lot. So the NEA can really support the design fees and public art installation associated with projects like this. Now moving on to Grand Prairie, Texas. Arts and cultural activities were used as a job development strategy here and a way to really beautify the city. The city of Grand Prairie hired artists to train ex-offenders in public art making and maintenance, and not only did they drive new pieces of public art across the city, but also served as a conduit and steward for maintaining the existing pieces of public art in the city's collection. It was a really interesting way to reconnect ex-offenders with the community and establish relationships with their fellow residents. In the Twin Cities, Minnesota, an arts organization called Springboard for the Arts trained and commissioned several hundreds of artists to activate and bring attention to local businesses that were affected by construction of new light rail transit lines. What was interesting about this project, it was a new strategy that businesses employed to hire artists versus traditional marketing and advertising campaigns to provide both employment for those artists, and it really was a new creative attraction technique to generate more money for local businesses. So when you're thinking about projects that might be really disruptive in terms of construction, Artists can really be used as a conduit to activate space, to really show the vibrancy and activity that's still taking place there and keep local businesses active. And then lastly, in San Francisco and in Mesa, Arizona, they are engaging a range of local artists and designers to create temporary prototypes of street furniture and sculpture that help to both animate and activate public space. And more interestingly, the prototyping of these ideas is really an exercise to inform a longer-term pedestrian transportation plan for key corridors in the city.
So thanks, Jen. And two programs that I think have supported a lot of what you're talking about are the Our Town program and the Artworks Grant program. And if you could share with folks the details on these come around several times a year. How do folks connect with these dollars?
Great, absolutely, I'd be happy to. So in addition to the Our Town and Artworks program, I also wanted to touch very quickly on Challenge America. But let's really begin at the top of sort of this funding list, which is the Our Town program. And I'll just say, overarching for all applications to the NEA, eligible applicants have to be nonprofit 501c3 organizations that have at least 3 years of programming history, government entities, or federally recognized tribes. And so I want to be really clear here is that you don't necessarily have to be an arts and culture organization to apply to the NEA. You just have to fit that eligibility requirement. So with the Our Town program, that is really our creative placemaking program. Many of the projects I just shared with you were supported via Our Town, and these are specifically partnership projects that require a partnership between a local or tribal government and at least one nonprofit 501c3 organization. And it's really all about driving community development via arts, culture, and design interventions. I would say to keep in mind, our next deadline will be in September 2017, and we will be releasing our grant guidelines in May of this year. And this is one of our larger grant funding programs, ranging from $25,000 to $200,000. And then the next category is artwork. This is our general grant-making category, where we fund a wide range of projects, everything from design to theater to festivals to public art to arts education. And this program has two deadlines annually. We just had one in early February, and the next one will be in July. And this is a program that supports projects between $10,000 and $100,000. And lastly, I added Challenge America up here because this is a program that's particularly focused on extending the reach of arts to underserved communities. It's $10,000 straight funding, with the next deadline being April of 2017. And the way that we define underserved could be by age, ethnicity, income, disability, or geography. And we often refer to this program as a great gateway to NEA funding. Guest artist projects, arts events such as festivals, cultural tourism, or public art are all eligible activities there. And I think it's important to stress that all of these programs are project-based. So that means they last from 1 to 2 years, and you come forth with a very particular bandit project proposal. So just a few things to know about NEA funding. We do require a one-to-one match for all the funding. So we're hoping that you are able to leverage that locally. And keep in mind that the match does not have to be cash. It could be in kind, including donated materials, volunteer time, donated space as well. And the other thing that's really important to keep in your frame of mind is that typically for both the Art Town and the Artworks Grant program, from the time of application to the project start date, it's roughly 10 months of review. So you really want to look out in the future and plan your projects accordingly with that awareness, because we can't fund any project activities that take place before our earliest eligible start date. And we're really clear about that in our grant guidelines. And the other thing I just want to stress is we cannot fund construction or land acquisition. The projects that I shared and showed with you, The only types of construction that we can fund is the commissioning and installation of public art. And then we can fund the design fees. So we're talking about architecture fees, landscape architecture fees, urban designer fees, but we cannot actually fund the construction of those projects. And then since we are an arts agency, we have review criteria that I always like to flag for folks. Make sure that you get a good understanding of what we mean by artistic merit. That is roughly kind of good grant writing, making sure that your budget aligns with your project activities, that it's reasonable, and the scope and scale of the project is appropriate for the level of funding you're requesting. And then we have something called artistic excellence. So that's where you want to make sure that you are collaborating locally or regionally or nationally with artists, designers, cultural institutions that can really lend some expertise to your particular project. And these two review criteria are both equally weighted, so I would just flag that for you to make sure you check out. And lastly, I think it's really interesting to know the way that NEA adjudicates its funding is through a public external panel process. So that means we get together five panelists, four of which have some types of arts culture expertise to bring to a project review, and the other is a layperson that's more broadly representative of the American public. And so I put up the link there just to get a sense for more details about those three grant programs I just reviewed. So make sure you log on there to take a look. And so just since I'm talking formally about the Our Town program, I thought it would be helpful to introduce a really great rural example from Wilson, North Carolina. And it was focused on an abandoned vacant lot. What you see here are whirligigs. These are large-scale kinetic sculptures by the artist Vola Simpson, based out of Wilson, North Carolina. And these whirligigs were originally installed on his farm and desperately in need of repair. So the town of Wilson envisioned a public park that would anchor Main Street and help to serve as a community destination and wanted to showcase Simpson's incredible whirligigs. They were such a unique local asset. So where the NEA was able to provide support is we funded landscape design fees for the park space, as well as the restoration and installation of the whirligigs for display. But beyond that, a really strategic apprenticeship program also served as job training to employ locals and build skill sets in welding. As you can see, these are very large-scale sculptures, most of which are 30 to 50 feet high, and they required a significant amount of conservation. So the city of Wilson, North Carolina, really built expertise up in art conservation, and an incredible unexpected impact was that the park was able to help also anchor redevelopment of the old historic tobacco market buildings, places that had long stood abandoned since the tobacco industry dried up. So I think that was a really interesting and exciting spark of redevelopment as a result of investment in an arts and cultural amenity in downtown Wilson. And so in our artwork design program, now I just want to caveat that we have a visual arts program, we have a theater program, we have arts education program. I chose design to highlight for this audience in particular. And we can fund everything from the design of public space to hiring landscape architects to funding community planning processes to help jumpstart and prototype ideas for communities. And in Philadelphia, we funded an organization called the Tiny WPA, which is a design studio that has contracts with local businesses in the city, design public street furniture and signage. In fulfillment of designing these public space elements, Tiny WPA trains local youth to build skills in carpentry, engineering, design, and math. And a really big win for uniquely designed public space elements as well as youth training and skill set building. So I think this is just meant to help foster some inspiration as you're thinking about projects and how they really connect to different sectors so that you can have that holistic community revitalization in your work.
Thanks, Jen. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I've got a couple more questions for you. What should communities consider as they're taking a look at NEA funds?
Sure. So I will run through this fairly quickly. But first and foremost, you really need to be thinking about local partnerships. So look across the nonprofit, government, private sectors to really align your partnerships for a specific project. So for example, the City of Wilson partnered with the Downtown Association, local businesses, university that could guide the conservation work, as well as real estate developers to acquire the land for park developments. Also, be creative in looking across sectors. Some of our most successful projects include involvement from everyone from the mayor to a local farmer, to the police chief, to church and community groups. Arts and culture and design projects can really be integrated to address a range of community development issues that cut across sectors. So be thinking about that quite creatively. And another key tenet of creative placemaking projects is that these projects are based on assets that exist in the community. Local places, people, physical infrastructure, all of these things that might hold aesthetic, historic, or economic value and make your place unique, be thinking about a creative placemaking strategy that builds off of that. So this is an asset-based approach to community revitalization versus a deficit-based approach. And finally, since we are the National Endowment for the Arts, be sure that your project taps expertise from the arts sector, culture, or design communities. It might be artists that exist in your backyard, in your community or region, or from across the nation. So make sure you have artist fees as part of your proposed project budget. And keep in mind that artists exist in every aspect of your community, from the local choir teacher to knitting clubs to performers. And also just take a look at the webinars that we have throughout the year to get some more inspiration based on the various opportunities you might consider applying to. And lastly, just keep in mind that NEA's federal funding is just one piece of the arts and cultural infrastructure in our country. So I just wanted to flag that 40% of our grant funding goes directly to state and regional partners. And every state and U.S. territory has a state arts agency that distributes money throughout the state and has their own grant-making programs. So they could be a great thought partner in your project, and I would just encourage you to check out that link and connect to your state arts agencies as well for the opportunities that might be relevant to you locally.
And the sky really is the limit for what you will fund. As communities are thinking about something creative for their cities, you know, where should they go for inspiration?
Yes, great. And it looks like, Andy, I just lost connection, so if you can flip to the next slide. You know, I would just say, depending on your community needs, these are three great programs and partnerships to explore further. Our Mayor's Institute on City Design, which serves mayors on training of being chief urban designers in their communities. Our Citizens Institute on Rural Design, we will have a call and open opportunity later this year to provide resource team members to work with a city or a town of less than 50,000 on a rural visioning workshop for whatever issue they're interested in. But we also have some great resources up on that website as well. And then lastly, the Kaboom Play Everywhere Design Challenge really brought to light 100 brilliant ideas from communities across the country on how to integrate play into public space. So lots of these are great innovative design ideas, many of which are very low cost, but go a very long way to animating and activating space. And I talked about a few of our Our Town creative placemaking projects, but we have a website, this one here, Exploring Our Town, that features 77 in-depth case studies from across the country. So dive into that to get some inspiration as well. We have projects from tribal, rural, mid-sized cities, and large urban communities. Here's just an example of one of those case studies. And then Springboard for the Arts is a fantastic organization. They have a platform called the Creative Exchange with lots of great toolkits to implement a range of projects that engage local artists, from artist-designed bike racks to guide for business districts to work with local artists. These are really tactical how-to guides with a range of resources and information to get you started, and lots of great free downloads there. And then lastly, in December, the NEA launched a book. It's How to Do Creative Placemaking, an action-oriented guide for making places better. It's downloadable from our website, and again includes case studies and describes the diverse ways that arts organizations and artists can play an essential role in the success of communities across the country. So with that, I hope I'm leaving you with some good food for thought on ways you might connect the sustainable reuse of brownfields, integrate and utilize arts and cultural strategies to re-energize these places, imagine their future, and connect people to them. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jen. So I'm going to introduce now James Thiel, and James is going to help us tie it all together. James is the planning director with the City of Omaha, and he's responsible for long-range master planning, capital improvement programming, transportation planning, and redevelopment project planning and implementation. He served in the public sector for 40 years in every aspect of urban planning and in the operating and administering of economic development and community development programs. James and the City of Omaha have tapped into these resources that we're talking about today, and James is going to talk to us a little bit about Omaha's redevelopment efforts as they relate to some of these funds. So, James?
Thank you. In recent years, Omaha has benefited from a number of federal grants and awards of technical assistance. I'd like to present a glimpse of how these grants and award make an impact on our community. The heart of Omaha's Jazz District is and always has been the intersection at 24th and Lake Street. There are many cultural amenities at this location, such as the Martin Luther King Memorial, a jazz-themed pocket park that celebrates Omaha's historic jazz era, decorative banners and street signs, as well as Love's Jazz and Art Center. 2012 Our Town grant from the National Endowment for the Arts provided funding leading to three important activities that strengthen the district as an important creative hub in Omaha. The grant was a catalyst for the redevelopment of the Carver Savings and Loan Bank building, the creation of the Village Square Development Plan, and the Fair Deal Marketplace. The $100,000 NEA grant leveraged an additional $105,000 in cash and in-kind contributions from the community. Those funding sources included government as well as nonprofit organizations. Working closely with urban planner and artist Theaster Gates and the Rebuild Foundation, the local Bemis Center for Contemporary Arts launched Carver Bank in March 2013. Carver Bank provides space for creativity, collaboration between artists, and community partnerships. According to the Bemis Center, in a short time, Carver Bank has created several important milestones and established many significant partnerships, including over 8,000 visitors, 13 exhibits, 13 artists, 16 artists in residence, and 136 programs for the community. The Village Square Development Plan reimagined an underutilized parking lot and commercial buildings at 24th and Lake Streets. It creates a highly detailed strategy for the redevelopment of the commercial hub located at the intersection and reaffirms the history of North Omaha through creative placemaking. As part of the NEA grant, recommendations were made to activate 24th Street south of the Village Square. These recommendations included using shipping containers on vacant land for small retail spaces and developing a fresh food grocery. These recommendations ultimately became reality as the Fair Deal Marketplace. About two blocks south of the 24th and Lake Street intersection is the marketplace named after the historic Fair Deal Cafe. Omaha Economic Development, approximately 40-year-old nonprofit developer in Omaha, received $800,000 of HHS Community Economic Development Healthy Food Financing Initiative funds for this $2.4 million project. The funding provided by HHS and the developer leveraged almost $1 million from the community, including funds provided by the City of Omaha, private foundations, and Omaha businesses. This portion of Omaha is a food desert, and funding for the cafe and small grocery store were very important to the continued revitalization of the area. The city assisted the Fair Deal Marketplace by donating vacant land for the project and has constructed a public parking lot adjacent to the marketplace. Nearly $400,000 of community development block grant funds has been invested in property acquisition, environmental remediation, and construction of the parking lot. As you can see, the Fair Deal Marketplace used shipping containers that were then converted into retail space, as well as construction of the grocery store and cafe. The 24th and Lake Street area isn't the only part of the city being revitalized. Over the past 6 years, Omaha has received approximately $900,000 in state and federal funds for brownfield inventories, assessments, and reuse planning. Nearly all of these funds and technical assistance have benefited areas of the city where there's a concentration of low and moderate income residents. One of the largest, more recent projects is the redevelopment of the former Pleasant View housing development. Pleasant View was built in the mid-20th century to provide housing for low-income individuals of our community. It was managed, owned and managed by the Omaha Housing Authority. It was demolished several years ago, and the land was sold to a nonprofit developer, 75 North, who envisioned the site as a purpose-built community. Nebraska Department of Environmental Quality provided funds for the investigation of several brownfields located in the redevelopment area, which included the former Pleasant View housing site. These funds were provided to the state by the EPA. The studies conducted on this site revealed the presence of acrolein in soil gas along the southern edge of the property. Follow-up investigation did not confirm the results of the initial study, but as a precaution, site design and engineering controls eliminated this potential exposure of risk to residents. The same funding also expanded the study area into the adjacent Prospect Village neighborhood, which was the target of intensive neighborhood revitalization in 2014 and 2015. Several brownfield sites were identified by these studies, and limited soil, groundwater, and soil gas sampling was conducted to evaluate health risks posed by these sites. Contamination was not discovered. However, it's always important to make sure that we protect the residents of our redeveloping areas. Omaha has a long history of an industry located in and near residential areas. From 2011 to 2013, a coalition led by the Metropolitan Area Planning Agency managed a brownfield assessment grant from the EPA. Through this effort, more than 30 studies were conducted, including an area-wide plan. More information on this initiative can be found at the link presented on this slide or by searching for Omaha Brownfields on a web browser such as our good friend Google. The city's strong relationship with EPA has led to city staff managing the Omaha Lead Superfund site. In 2015, the city and EPA entered into a $41 million agreement to test lead concentration levels in soil for properties in Eastern Omaha and to clean up contaminated residential yards if lead levels exceeded the action level. This is the result of the historic lead refineries that were located in the eastern portion of Omaha. A portion of this money is set aside for public outreach and education, including the development and operation of the Omaha Lead Registry, which is a web-based GIS application that provides parcel-level information about the Omaha lead site and other lead mitigation programs led by this city, and that also includes our nonprofit partners. Through the EPA Region 7 office, Kansas State University Technical Assistance Office provided a brownfield team to look at two community organizations, two areas of the city with community partners working with the city. They are creating a reuse plan for Southside Terrace, historic housing development located in South Omaha, owned by the Omaha Housing Authority. That area is slated for revitalization very shortly. They're also conducting a study for the Park Avenue Neighborhood Association to represent a neighborhood in eastern Omaha which is rapidly redeveloping. Through federal programs like EPA's Making a Visible Difference and grants acquired from philanthropic organizations, numerous gardens and public spaces have been created. The city has community gardens on over 27 vacant lots throughout the city. These gardening activities include permaculture, refugee gardens, as well as traditional community gardens. All of these have benefited low and moderate income people in Omaha. Demand for the use of city's vacant lot has increased in recent years, which has led to the development of the Vacant Lot Toolkit. The toolkit provides information on how to make vacant lots productive, whether they're owned by the city, a nonprofit group, or a private party. Because of Omaha's problems with lead soil contamination, it ties in very well with our lead registry that people can then search to see the conditions for that particular lot and take the proper precautions. Omaha is now evaluating how community solar can be used to benefit low and moderate income residents. Grants from the state and federal Department of Energy may play an important role in our plans. Promoting and developing healthy homes is also an important part of our future plans. Here's some contact information that for those people who may be interested in some of the activities in Omaha.
James, amazing work that you're doing in Omaha, so thank you for that. We're going to jump now into the Q&A. We've got some time remaining at the webinar, at the end of the webinar. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask a couple of questions that we've received to each of the speakers. So Joel, if you're available, I'm going to start with you. And one of the questions that we received, you had mentioned the deadline of June 30th for the RTCA program. Talk to folks a little bit about what they need to do to figure out when the LWCF funds are available through their states.
Okay, great question. The starting point would be with the agency at the state level that administers the program, and as I mentioned earlier, the way to sort of search is just your state. You know, if it's say Maryland, you just Maryland LWCF or something to that effect in the Google search, and that should at least point you in the closer direction or right direction. And usually on those websites would be some indication of the deadlines associated with the granting agency. They're all over the board in terms of each state is unique, and each state sets up their own deadlines, and they vary throughout the year.
And you mentioned the Outdoor Recreation Legacy Partnership Program. You're in the middle of a cycle now and will likely start a new cycle sometime soon. Do you have a sense of when you'll make awards and when you'll make the next cycle open?
So yes, we hope to make awards in the next month or so. The next cycle, we at this point, because the federal government, we do at the federal government level, we do not have our appropriations for fiscal year 2017. It is unknown at this point whether or not there's funding available for that program. We remain hopeful that there will be, and once the appropriations, should they come about here in the next 2 months or so, once that's, if we do have available funding, then there'll be announcements on grants.gov following that.
Perfect. And if you could comment, a question here about the GroundWorks USA partnership with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. What are folks' opportunities with that?
Sure. GroundWorks and EPA, or EPA and the National Park Service, have been in a long-term relationship in terms of the help the creation of GroundWorks USA, which is really a network of nonprofit organizations. And I believe there's a little less than 20 of them out there in various urban jurisdictions across the country. So many of the projects the RTCA worked on, I mentioned about health or, you know, even very specific projects associated with transforming brownfield-type areas or urban areas in that community, park and recreation-type projects. All those are the type of projects, and youth involvement as well, are all the types of projects that are available through GroundWorks.
Perfect. And Harold, if you're out there, Harold, a question here for you. You had mentioned that the opportunity to pursue community economic development program dollars was, you know, soon upon us. When do you imagine that folks are going to need to submit applications for that?
Sure. Applications, the funding opportunity announcement will probably go out around late April, and generally the announcement will be on out in the street, as we call it, for 60 days. And so they'll have to have an application in by June, maybe late June, third week in June.
So that's coming up pretty soon. And another question here, we've got a number of rural communities across the country participating on the webinar today. Are there any distinct or particular resources available from HHS in your program to help rural communities?
Yes. We have a program called the Rural Community Development Program, and it's a federal grant program that works with regional and tribal organizations to manage safe water systems in rural communities, and they provide low-income individuals access to safe and affordable drinking water in their homes. They also strengthen economic development conditions and opportunities in those communities, and do water supply and wastewater disposal. They also provide training and technical assistance to individuals running in wastewater management, and they construct and improve and preserve water supply disposable systems in a cost-effective manner. They support Homeland Security Program, which provides safety and security training and technical assistance to state and regional and national grantees.
Excellent. Jen, a couple of questions for you here. Some tribal communities are on the phone as well and on the webinar. Do you have any examples of some good NEA tribal projects?
Yes, so we have a couple great tribal projects that I would encourage you to check out on the Exploring Our Town case study website. One of which that comes to mind is the Santo Domingo Pueblo in New Mexico, and that was a focus on sort of doing cultural asset mapping to understand sort of the historical context, a lot of the structures in that pueblo, and then to formulate an apprenticeship program to restore a lot of those pueblos' historic buildings, and particularly the cultural center and facility there. And then we've also funded a project on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and they've been doing work to design new powwow grounds and as well as a cultural and youth facility. So we're funding the planning process that's taking place on the reservation with the community, as well as the architecture, landscape architecture, and other design fees associated with that.
And another question here for you, Jen. Just help communities think strategically where your dollars can play. You mentioned that you can't do construction or capital projects. But design is really where communities need to be thinking about your particular resources, correct?
Yes, I would say that, but I would also say to be thinking about it as ways to prototype various ideas or perhaps to activate or animate vacant lots in the interim. If they're, you know, you're trying to generate particular interest in a neighborhood or community or activate vacant storefronts, I think you can really think about arts and culture and particularly our funding programs to supporting some of those artist activities that can help bring new attention and energize things that might be happening in the community, even if it's part of a long-term planning process. And certainly we can also fund, as you mentioned, design fees and the community visioning process. But I would also say to think creatively about some of those temporary activities that can generate a lot of excitement and enthusiasm for the longer-term vision.
And Jen, just one more thing that I want you to highlight, just because it's such a critical factor of your application process, and it's the artistic excellence. And can you talk to folks the importance of having an artist associated with the project up front? Is that a critical factor?
Yes, so you definitely want to be thinking about that. You might have sort of an artist collective or a local cultural institution. Think about museums, universities, local community design centers, or even individuals that you might want to partner on a project with. And you even want to articulate who that person or organization might be or your selection process and how you might bring them to the table. We acknowledge if you're applying for a grant and you're not finding out for 10 months, you might not have all those details lined up, but you certainly want to be really strategic in thinking about that, which is why I would say reach out to your state arts agency and local arts agency to get connected to some of those arts and cultural leaders to help get the wheels turning.
And this is a jump ball, and I think it's a National Park Service NEA question appropriate, but somebody is interested in signage and wayfinding and your interest in those particular kinds of projects.
Sure. So I'm happy to speak from the NEA. We have funded projects where either through our Citizens Institute on Rural Design and working with rural communities in helping to do some wayfinding planning and bringing wayfinding experts to a community to do that planning process hands-on alongside the community, as well as we've funded projects in both Our Town and Challenge America. Those are two great programs that have been able to support wayfinding projects. Now, what you want to think about there, at least for the NEA, again, is that artistic excellence piece. And who are the designers, artists, sort of the creative processes that you want to put in place to make something really unique happen locally in your community?
And Joel, I don't know if the National Park Service and your Land and Water Conservation Fund, do you do signage, wayfinding? Is that a focus of yours or beyond the scope?
That would be beyond the scope.
Gotcha. And James, the last question is for you. We've got someone here from Ann Carroll from EPA.
Hi, thanks for your presentation. I was just curious because you've done a lot of different projects, and I was wondering, A, how you're tracking the impacts of those projects, and I might want to connect you with some researchers at the University of Louisville who are actually developing a community benefits calculator. So if you're doing any tracking or have documented any impact from your work, and if you're willing to be connected to other researchers.
In terms of our analysis, I guess we really have not done a consolidated across-the-board approach. However, in the Prospect Village area, what we have done is through resident survey, we've kind of created a baseline, and then we were following over every 2 years a follow-up survey to see what sort of impact we've had over time related specifically to those households in the area.
Okay, thanks so much, James. We're going to have to wrap up our webinar here, and I want to just give so many thanks to all of our speakers. So thank you to Joel and Harold and Jen and James. Excellent job today, Andy. Thank you for all your great moderation. There were a few questions that we couldn't get to because we ran out of time. But we wanted to, we know the contact information for everyone is available on CLUIN. And so please reach out with your questions so that you can get follow-up. Thank you so much. Jean, is there any last thing you want to mention to our group?
Yep. I'll walk everybody through just a few final reminders before we go ahead and close out today's live broadcast. A number of you had asked for speaker contact information, and I just wanted to remind everybody, as Amy noted, you'll find that on the seminar homepage, which will remain active after today's session. We also have copies of the presentation material posted, as well as a collection of related websites and resources. Some people were looking for copies of the Brownfields documents that Amy was referencing earlier, so I just wanted to confirm that those are posted as part of the seminar's resource page, so you can go ahead and access those materials now. I will ask if you could take just a brief moment and fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you happen to participate in a group, each person can fill out the feedback form to get their own copy of a participation or feedback confirmation message. So just real quickly, if you follow the link to the seminar feedback form, you will see a box at the bottom of that form that you can check and basically confirm that you participated live for the entire session. Once you check that box and you complete or submit your feedback, you should have access to an online certificate that you can then print out or save for your own records. A lot of people ask if we offer CEUs or PDHs. We don't necessarily issue those, but many times our participants are able to submit feedback, print out these certificates, keep copies of the materials that, as noted, are already posted for download, and then save the registration email, and that's enough to document their participation to earn credit. So again, if you need copies of those materials, they're on the seminar homepage. I will ask again each of you to fill out that feedback form and let me know what you thought of today's delivery. As noted, I want to thank all of the individuals who joined us from across the country today. We had over 270 people chime in live, and I want to thank all of the organizers who helped put on today's session. As soon as an archived version of today's webinar is available for on-demand playback, you'll receive an automatic email with instructions on how to access it. So with that, I'll go ahead and formally close.